Thank you, Mr. Patchinger, and good afternoon to you all. Good to always good to be home, be back. I had the same thought about that hymn as we sang the one line about armored with all Christ-like graces. The theme for the Winter Family Weekend this year is armor up, based on Ephesians 6. So I thought that was a well-chosen hymn for that time. I'll make a few brief comments about our trip. We just returned home last evening. First flight we can catch back to get back in time after our morning class yesterday. And it still doesn't even sound right to say I was teaching class 10 at FI yesterday. But we were there, and flight left at 3:10. We got in a few minutes early, and so it takes a while. You have to wait for a gate to open up if you're ahead of time. And I don't know when I've seen luggage collection take that long. I was all prepared to have the belt stop and no suitcases in sight, but it finally did make it through, and we got the last of our luggage pieces about an hour after the plane landed. So it was a little bit delayed this time. So I don't know whether it's just because of more luggage flying with more people. I don't know. We had a full flight last night. Well, the trip was profitable again. This is now the third semester that I've taught this class, one full year from the January to August 2021 academic year, which was delayed, as you know, from an August to May start, went January to August. Then 2 weeks later, they started another one, a bit delayed. Usually it starts more like the middle of August. This one was August 30th, but they did get the start in, and graduation is set for May the 22nd this coming year, so they're back on a basic schedule. This round was a bit difficult with the scheduling. I talked with Mr. David Johnson, and probably next academic year, we'll shift our first module down there to sometime in November, early to mid-November. Early December has always been the date for the Ministerial Board of Director meetings, and normally that might not conflict, except that Mr. Franks teaches one class in this modern church history class for me. I've asked him to present his material on the early Sabbatarians in New England. And so that is class 2, the way we have it structured right now. But he was tied up all day Monday, the first week we were there, and all day Tuesday and Wednesday morning with Ministerial Board of Directors meetings. He's not on the board, but he is the president and involved in all the meetings. So his first availability was Wednesday afternoon, which meant there was no point in starting class 1 that I teach until Wednesday morning. So normally we have one class every day for 2 weeks, but it turned out we had to have 5 within 3 days when we first got there. So a little bunched up at the beginning, but we'll try to even that out next year by changing the schedule. Class 10 was yesterday morning, and then we go back in May from May the 9th through the 19th, the last day of classes actually for the last 10 classes of this church history course. The atmosphere in the home, in the headquarters office remains the same as we've seen before. You've probably heard Mr. Franks mention it from time to time, that he just enjoys going to work, coming to work, and there are not palpable tensions or concerns, which wasn't always true in the past, sadly. I don't mean in Cogwa, but in other situations that he was involved in. Of course, we all have our own patterns and mannerisms, I'm sure. We got a kick out of one of the office doors, Greg McLeod, who is our maintenance man and just takes care of looking after the building and shipping and any requests for literature to be mailed, which aren't much anymore. It's almost all electronic now, but he takes care of all of that. But he had a big sign on his door one morning listing all of his job responsibilities. And then he got into, you know, counselor, caring big brother. And then at the bottom, it had all that and then he had a little bag of chips taped to the door. So all that and a bag of chips. Where they come up with these things, I don't know. But anyway, we get a little bit of fun and teasing each other too. So, but at any rate, the class was enjoyable again. I did some tweaking and adjusting this year and making a few differences, allow a little more time in one area, a little less time in another, and it's helpful to try to even it out as we go forward. We did begin recording, and we'll take a look at it, and we'll see. It's possible it could be on FI Online fairly soon, within less than a year. We'll see. It just depends on how it looks and what other priorities there might be, but at least we have started to record these first 10 classes and then 10 more coming up in May. This year's class, as far as students, is quite different from last year's. Last year's class had three significantly older students. I mean, at least some of them were grandparents. And so we had a few grandparents last time. No grandmas and grandpas this time. We had, of the 13 students there currently, 12 of them are, I would say, between the ages of 20 and 25, which is obviously typical college age. There's one lady, in fact, she teased, when we met her, she said, "Yes, I'm mom in the class." And she is probably old enough to be their mother. But she's also quite new to the church, which has been very interesting, very sweet and kind person. And just a joy to be around as she begins this journey. She has all kinds of questions. She always wants to talk after class some more. She has been keeping the Sabbath for about a year. That was the first thing she discovered. And she enrolled in Foundation Institute in August, having never kept a Feast of Tabernacles. And so this was her first Feast of Tabernacles this past year. So she's had quite the journey in that way. And we enjoyed meeting her and all the other students, some of whom we had known at least peripherally. One of the young ladies was with us on the Israel trip in 2019. She's actually from South Africa. Her family has moved to the States since then. I believe they live in Nashville, if that's my understanding. So she's actually in the U.S. now. A set of twins, young ladies that we met at the feast in San Diego in 2017, and actually they lived for a number of years in Western Canada. Their dad's involved in the oil business, and he was working out of Calgary, Alberta for about 3 or 4 years when they were much younger. So they're familiar with that aspect of our background and travels too. Our return for the second module, Modern Church History 2, will be in early May. The first class is set for, class 11 total, for Monday, May the 9th, the day after Mother's Day. And then school year ends on the 19th, Thursday, with graduation Sunday, May the 22nd. It's fairly likely that we will be asked to stay, or we will stay for graduation as well, but we'll see how that plays out as we get closer. As always the case, always happy to be home. It's like going to the feast or going to camp when we used to do Camp Heritage for so long, or even the Winter Family Weekend. You think, we have a nice long time to be, and you turn around, and it's over, and you're packing to go home again. So, and that's just the way things are. Of course, while we were gone, we had some difficult news to process, and staying in touch through that old time. I think you all know that now, for the last two times, that Janelle and I have left for Texas to teach FI classes. Out of three times we've gone down there, twice now, we have all jointly had the sad and difficult experience of watching via emails and phone calls and prayers and trying to console and comfort and deal with members who were directly dealing with the death of their loved one. And those loved ones, in each case, of course, were veteran members of the body of Jesus Christ in this congregation. It was a journey traveled together with sadness, with appeals to God for His wisdom and His love and His mercy, and in the end, with the temporary, we believe, sadness and grief that His gentle, and we have to trust, all-wise and all-loving and all-knowing and all-concerned answer was, "Not now, my deeply loved children. Not now." That's not easy. That's not easy. And for us, we felt the added distance, literally, of feeling like we needed to be here. But you can only be in one place at one time, as we've discovered. That's a journey that is talked about in God's Word in a number of places. Probably one of the most famous psalms ever talks about that journey a little bit. I don't mean for this to be a discouraging message. I mean for it to be quietly supportive, quietly acknowledging the truth of the way things are. I think we're all well aware that this is the way things work. This is the way things work. Some of you have walked through this journey. I think we all know who goes back so far and one case, I don't think he'd mind my using his name. And Tony Dial, of course, and Leon Leonard attended their first service together. Tony was telling me today, 53 years ago. 53 years ago. So we have a veteran church of God. One of the other members was speaking to me about it when I walked in today, and he couldn't go any further. He got all choked up, as I did when I tried to call Mr. Patchinger. He had asked me to repeat myself. It is the way things are for now. This life is not intended to be permanent. We understand that intellectually. And it's something we do go through and journey together. David talks about it in the 23rd Psalm. This is often a psalm that is memorized. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Those are calming words. And the words that follow are too, but they're a different focus. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. In this case, the rod and staff are used and illustrated as the elements of a shepherd for care and support and concern and rescue. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Well, when you understand the meaning of forever, you know what we're talking about. Obviously, David is long dead and buried. Peter mentioned that in his sermon on the day of Pentecost in AD 31. He said, "Let me speak to you freely of the patriarch David. He is buried. His tomb is with us to this day. He has not ascended to heaven, you know. And yet he's called in the same book of Acts a man after God's own heart." Isn't that what we want to be? Men and women after God's own heart? The sermon you listened to last week, Mr. Kylo, on assembling together. Assembling ourselves together. We just heard it this morning for the first time. We had to cancel services in Youngstown last week because of a COVID situation. Charlie and Barb Moore. And we asked for prayers for them today. They certainly need them. So they listened this morning, and it was the first time we'd had a chance to hear it. Excellent message. Superb message. Tying together Hebrews 10, 24 and 25 verses we've read hundreds of times. And giving it a context. Giving it a context. Well, I know that every one of us has been through this journey with someone else at some point in our lives, very likely. The phrase, the valley of the shadow of death. Every one of us, excluding younger children who haven't yet grasped the concept of death, knows intellectually that someday we're going to walk through that valley ourselves. That's just the way it works. We're coming to the place where we are seeing our age cohorts disappearing before our eyes. A friend of mine who was a pastor with the United Church of God, a roommate of mine from Ambassador College, died just after the feast this past year. And going through and doing this class and checking all kinds of sources to try to find out who's where and what's, and I came across a website. It's, I guess, put together by someone who's keeping tabs on all the alumni of Ambassador College over the years, and just going down through the list of all those we've known, and some I hadn't seen. I spotted a young lady who was in my class who died 15, 16 years ago from cancer. I hadn't known. I mean, I hadn't had any contact or touch with a lot of people over the years, but you just see those names and you say, whoa, had no idea. Had no idea she was 54. These are the things that happen in life. This is what is the nature of our construction. the way God made us. I had a series of pictures, illustrates it in one way or the other. I had come across pictures I'd kept for some time that I wanted to show Mr. Kylo, Clyde Kylo, with whom we've been friends for a long time. And it's a picture of just the two of us, several pictures, five or six pictures, and the most recent one was taken in August of this year. And we look the way we look. Frightening, I know, but we do. And then the next one, time-wise, was taken in the summer of 2005, his first year as president of the United Church of God, and my first year as director of Camp Heritage at camp. And we looked the way we looked 16 years ago. The one before that was taken in December of 1995 at the formative conference of the United Church of God in Cincinnati, December 1995. And things are beginning to change. And then there was one taken in January 1986 when we were together on a ministerial refresher program in Pasadena the month that Mr. Armstrong died. And then there was one taken right in front of Ambassador Auditorium at a ministerial conference in January of 1978. And that one looked vastly different. And I don't mean just because he had a bushy mustache. Some of us who don't have as much bushiness in some other areas certainly did back then. And you look at those pictures and you say, where have the last 43 years gone, 44 years gone? And they have flown past. So we understand, the scripture says, it is appointed to men once to die, Hebrews 9:27. All we have to do is look around us to know life is limited, or look at a series of pictures taken with friends over the last 4.5 decades and recognize that. But we also know, frankly, it's probably the rare person who doesn't make that difficult trip through the valley of the shadow of death more than once in a lifetime. We all do it ourselves. Although sometimes unexpected sudden death, perhaps you're not aware that you're in the valley. But we make it with other people, too. I remember making it for the first time that it meant anything to me when I was 11, with my mom, who died from cancer in March of 1963. And it was a little hard to understand for a young fellow, but of course I knew. I mean, I was old enough to know what was going on. And others over the years, and serving in the ministry, you make it multiple times. Multiple times. I've kept a record. I'd have to go back and look of how many funerals I've conducted. I have no idea how many it is offhand. I'm certain it's over 100, but I don't know for sure. That would be really not many in 48 years in the ministry. It's a valley, you know, that is difficult sometimes to walk through for those who are accompanying on the journey as it is to the one who's actually there. It's a valley you can't enter, then change your mind and retrace your steps to get out of. You have to go through it. Sometimes we walk through that valley or go along with others through their valley, and we come out the other side. The shadow was looming large over us, but it didn't claim our life. And sometimes maybe not the life of the one we were with, if it was just a brush with death. Those things happen too. But you know, sometimes we walk or accompany others in their walk, and we find the valley is more like one of our great national parks. Probably one of my favorites, and I know my wife's because we spent time on our honeymoon there back in 1973, Yosemite National Park. It's called Yosemite Valley, but really it's a box canyon. It's really a box canyon. Sometimes the valley of the shadow of death is that way too. There's no exit, just an end to it, and people walk into the shadows of the valley knowing they won't be leaving. And that's the way it is. It's a deeply moving experience to walk in that valley with someone who knows and who you know won't be leaving. But you know that you may get out of the valley this time, but they won't. It's life-changing. When we spend years with a group of people and we get to know and love them, and when you walk through that valley together, even if it's not your own life at stake, Psalm 23 comes to mind. In verse 1, it's so well known, memorized by so many, it's a song, and so it's written in the style of a songwriter or a poet. There's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of figurative speech, and there are metaphors, word pictures that aren't literal, but they symbolically express the truths of life. And in these first three verses and the ones that follow, David talks about God being a shepherd, peaceful, beautiful places in life based on walking a certain path. And that's the path we're supposed to walk. Those are the good times, and we shouldn't take them for granted. But David was also a realist, and he clearly understood that in the scheme of life, things are not always green pastures and still waters. Sometimes it's drought, rough water, and he addresses that reality in verse 4. But he says something there that's important for us, brethren, at times like this. He says, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. I will fear no evil. Why is that? Why is that? Evil in Hebrew comes from a word that means adversity, affliction. It's bad. It's a calamity. It's a displeasure, distress, sorrow, trouble. I won't be afraid of any of that. The psalm expresses the belief of a person who says, I will not fear it. Doesn't say he won't feel anything. It just says he's immune from, it's not immune from adversity, not immune from sorrow, but it says he or she is immune from fear. I will not fear. What is it that builds that kind of an immunity so that we can go and say with absolute confidence, I have no fear of evil? Every human is going to walk through that valley someday, but not many people are able to say that. It doesn't come naturally. Where does it come from? Well, if you have that kind of an immunity, brethren, you have a strong spiritual immune system. And, of course, immunities, we're talking a lot about these days, in the days of the pandemic, aren't we? You have a strong spiritual immune system, and that can only be built up as a result of God's power and His Spirit. It's the result of a spiritual work that He is doing in us. 5 weeks ago, I was sitting talking with Leon Leonard in his apartment, in his home. And he was tired. He had no energy. I said, can you drive? He said, I can, but only for a short time. And then he said, I just can't get out and stay out and last. So he was facing something. There were issues going on there. But he was still Leon. And we still could talk and joke about things. And his wife was out grocery shopping. And she came back when we were talking. And we had a chance to exchange a few pleasant words. These are not easy times. He had requested an anointed cloth from me just the week before. We had been out of town. We'd been visiting with our son and daughter-in-law for Thanksgiving. And so we mailed it from down in Newark, where they now live, having bought a house there. Where do these things come from? Where do people who have this kind of courage, where do they get that? Why is it that people can say, I'm okay, when they know they're not? Because they mean a different thing. It's not a statement of desperation. It's like David saying, I fear no evil. Jesus Christ made a very profound statement in the Gospel of John in chapter 8. He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, or set you free. One of the most marvelous blessings that you and I can be given is to be given the keys of truth and be able to unlock the chains of the fear of evil. This world around us doesn't know how to deal with it. We were flying back last night and sitting rather, you know, close quarters in an aircraft that's full. This particular aircraft, it's a Boeing 737-800 model. It has a little device on the back of each seat where you can pull down a tiny little clasp and you can put your smartphone up there and watch movies on your smartphone right in front of your face. And so I'm on the aisle. So over here in the aisle in front of me, there's a fellow with a movie on. Between the two seats right in front of us, there's somebody else with his phone up there and he's watching a movie. And I'm trying to look all around and avoid, because both movies, it was just a nonstop series of violence. I don't know what the movie was. In one case was worse than the other. But it was just, I mean, you can't hear anything, thankfully. And they're listening with their earbuds or whatever. But I thought, the movie industry plays on things like that. Those things are designed to provoke some kind of a reaction. And people do have fears. And yet Jesus Christ says, you'll know the truth shall set you free. I think that's one of the things he was talking about, that David, his ancestor, in one sense, said, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. You know, one of the greatest comforts in life is to have those things. And comfort's only an issue when you're in need of being comforted, to state the obvious. When you're in a painful or threatening or scary spot, that's when you need comfort. When things are going great, you don't need comfort. You just want more of the good stuff. That's one of the greatest blessings we have. It doesn't take away the concern or the grief or the challenge of facing those issues, as many of us know firsthand. But it does take away fear. It takes away fear. That's challenging. That's difficult. Probably all of us have had those things. We've walked through times with loved ones. I remember a favorite aunt of my wife's that lived in the Akron area. She died actually the year before we moved up here to Cleveland, at just 3 weeks short of 96. She was always just full of life. And whenever we'd go to visit her, she loved it when we would bring movies up to watch with her that she loved. She loved the movie Seabiscuit. She thought that was great, the racehorse. She loved My Big Fat Greek Wedding. She thought that was pretty funny, too, because it was so close to her heritage background. She was Serbian from Yugoslavia, and so the Eastern European, she thought that was pretty funny. But she didn't have, you know, a DVD player. And her television was one of these old, you know, furniture pieces, that floor models. So whenever we'd come, I'd bring our DVD player, and I'd have to get down on the floor and scramble around and try to hook up all the stuff and then put it in. And so I remember one time I'm, you know, pushing aside all the dust bunnies. She was in her 90s, after all, pushing aside the dust bunnies, and I finally got upset. Well, there, I got it taken care of. We're all set. She said, should we give you a round of applause? She was just a lot of fun to be around. We were with her on her 95th birthday, and she had a gentleman friend from her church who came to call on her frequently. She'd been a widow for many years, and her friend was 97 and still driving. Whenever we would visit, I would park my car 3 blocks away. But at one of her birthday parties, I think it was 94, my wife had made a little picnic lunch, and we're all eating, you know, sandwiches and chips, and she looks at the chips, she said, I shouldn't have so many chips. You know, I got to worry about the salt. And her friend looked at her and said, what for? You're 94 years old. So there's a certain humor that sets in there. But then on her 95th birthday, he wasn't able to be there. So we were visiting and the phone rings. My wife says, I'll get it, Aunt Jenny. So she goes and gets it. She comes back and says, it's Harry. He wants to talk to his sweetheart. She kind of smiles. She says, okay, but by the time I get to the phone, he'll probably be asleep already. So when somebody that full of life and spunk starts to make the decline and go into the valley, it's a little hard. And the last time we visited her, she could no longer speak to us. She couldn't see much. But my wife said, well, I'll play the piano for you. And she did, and Aunt Jenny started tapping her feet. And when we left, we knew it would be the last time. And when my wife spoke to her on the phone, and before we left, she said, when you go to sleep, when you wake up, I will be there. Now, that may have confused her no end, because in her mind, she was going to be in heaven, and she was going to be us there. But in time, she will understand. And these are just the way things are. She was a very religious person, I think she would have said, but obviously we didn't share the same beliefs. But these things do give comfort when we understand the truth, not just about ourselves, but even about those who didn't know the truth before. We've had family members who were concerned for family members who had died because they were afraid, if they were quite religious themselves, that this other family member wasn't. They never gave their heart to Jesus Christ. They never, you know, where are they now? You can understand. And in their minds, it's a very real fear. And we can try to explain to them what our beliefs are and what we know to be true from God's word. And about the only reaction you can get is, well, I can see that it gives you comfort. And it does. And it does. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And the phrase, you are with me. Brethren, we can't know the truth of that statement unless God is with us. In its greatest depth, we can't know it unless John 6:44 has happened. No man can come to me except the God who sent me draws him. And I will raise him up at the last day. I will raise him up at the last day. Those words are a comfort. Sometimes those we get to know and love have questions. They don't always have answers. Sometimes, perhaps, you talk to some who are advanced, really advanced ages. I've known a handful, not many, but a few centenarians in my life. Remarkable length of life, 100 years old. And talked to the Slagles about Mary Jo's mom. And the most humorous story of all is when the doctor came to congratulate her mother on her 100th birthday. And she wasn't hearing very well by then. And when he was informed, she understood that he was saying, I understand it's your birthday. And she says, really? We have the same birthday. And then he said something about her being 100 years old. And I'm told that she said, we're the same age. I think I might change doctors if my doctor were 100 years old. So there have been a handful. Her mom was one of the delightful ones that we had a chance to meet a little bit. I knew a gentleman in our church in Kansas City who was well past 100 when I knew him as a boy. In fact, he was 90 years older than I was. That goes some. My stepmother's mom was 102 when she died, but then just a handful. And, you know, you read something like Psalm 90, and you understand some of these concepts. It says in Psalm 90 about just the way things are with God. Before the mountains were brought forth, verse 2, Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. This is a psalm of a prayer of Moses. Before you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man to destruction and say, return, children of man, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past. There's another case of 1,000 years as a day right here in Psalm 90. Like a watch in the night, you carry them away like a flood. They're like a sleep. In the morning, they're like grass that grows up. In the morning, it flourishes and grows up. In the evening, it's cut down and withers. Very metaphoric. We've been consumed by your anger. By your wrath, we're terrified. You've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. Verse 9, for all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. Isn't that an interesting phrase? Sometimes that's the way it is. The days of our lives are 70 years. I don't know anybody that age. Okay, I do. The days of our lives are 70 years. And if by reason of strength they're 80, yet that boast, their boast is only labor and sorrow. It's soon cut off and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? As the fear of you, so is your wrath. So here's the lesson. Teach us to number our days. I think it's interesting that Mr. Rushton talked about that in the sermonette for the younger side. And Moses, writing this prayer or psalm that appears as Psalm 90, gives the same advice to the other end of life. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Make the best use of the time you have. Return, O Lord, how long? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us early with your mercy. Help us turn to you early. This could have been a page from that sermonette today. Satisfy us early with your mercy, early in our life, that we may rejoice and be glad all of our days. Start soon obeying God. That's the better way. Make us glad according to the days in which you've afflicted us, the years in which we've seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants, your glory to their children. Let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Psalms and verses that make us think, make us be aware of where we are and what happens in life. And it's times like this, we do think about it, don't we? We do think about it. Think about some of these things as we go through our lives. Mr. Rushton gave the example of some of the young people who serve God and others who perhaps not that young but still face challenges or difficulties in their lives. Look at 2 Kings chapter 20. 2 Kings 20. It says in verse 1, in those days Hezekiah was sick and near death. Now, if you've studied God's Word and studied the history a little bit, you know that Hezekiah was one of the righteous kings of Judah. When we were down in Texas this time, Mr. Ken Giese, who pastor in Fort Worth and Texas and Tulsa, Oklahoma, was teaching the last of his class on what was used to be called the former prophets, that the history of Israel is called. A portion of it was put on FI Online called the Conquest of Canaan. But he teaches basically Joshua, Judges, and 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. He was just finishing up 2 Kings. He teaches throughout the entire first semester. He has quite a commute. It's more than an hour one way from his home in Fort Worth. And so he teaches four classes a week during the entire first semester, two each day. So he's, and then he has only a tiny little 600-mile round trip to Tulsa from Fort Worth for the second church. Obviously, you don't do that as a circuit. But it says Hezekiah was sick and near death. He was talking with some of the students about Hezekiah and Josiah and some of the last kings. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, went to him and said, "Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live." He was about to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And then he turned his face toward the wall and he prayed to the Lord, saying, "Remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I have walked before you in truth and with a loyal heart and have done what was good in your sight." And he wept bitterly. These are difficult times. And it happened before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court that the word of the Eternal came to him and said, "Return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people." Interesting phrase. "Thus says the Lord, the God of David, your father, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Surely I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Eternal. And I will add to your days 15 years. And I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria." That miracle happened in his reign, where the Syrian army was just dead the next morning, 185,000. "I will defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David." Then Isaiah said, "Take a lump of figs." So they took and laid it on the boil, and he recovered. And you know the famous part, "What is the sign that the Lord will heal me, that I shall go up to his house on the third day? This is the sign to you from the Eternal, that he will do the thing which he has spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or backward 10 degrees? And Hezekiah said, "It's an easy thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees. That's going to happen anyway. But let the shadow go backward 10 degrees. On the sundial, we presume. So Isaiah the prophet cried out to the Lord. He brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down on the sundial of Ahaz. I don't know how much 10 degrees was then. We have 360 degrees the way we view a circle. So 10 degrees, 1/36th of a day, it's a little less than an hour, but it would be noticeable if that's what it was. Don't know for sure. And then it goes on, and as you find out, Hezekiah then did a very foolish move. He showed the king of Babylon all the treasures of God's house. Hello? But when he was told he shouldn't have done that, and he was told it won't happen in your days, all he could do was heave that sigh that we saw in the 90th Psalm and say, "Well, at least not in my life." But you know, even with the extra 15 years, do you know how old he was when he died? He was 54. He was 54. He was 39 years old when God healed him, when he was walking through the valley of the shadow of death. You know, sometimes it's just a challenge. Not all of us have the same length of time. The good times in life never get old. You enjoy them time and again. And we certainly have times like that that we will enjoy in our memories with those whose place is now secure in the family of God. We have good times and good memories. In our case, I think we owe Leon a second helping of chicken for one dinner one night because it was all out by the time he asked for seconds. So, I'm not sure just exactly how much enjoyment we'll have as spirit beings of food. I would like to think we still could. So, second helpings. Those are the things that we enjoy. The tough things in life, you don't ever get used to, even though you've been through them before. Like most pastors, I haven't lost count of how many hospitals I've been in. And I've had the thought so many times, how I wish I could go through and empty the wards. But that's not the time now. That's God's call when that will happen. When we have the knowledge of God's truth and His plan, then we see these things in a different light. We see these things in a different light. We understand when Solomon said in his writings, it's better to go into the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that's the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. The heart of the wise, he said, is in the house of mourning. Okay, it's not always easy to understand that, but we can read Proverbs, we can read Ecclesiastes, and we can begin to process these things. Take a look at something Paul talked about. It's written in the book of Acts. It's not one of his letters, but it's what he said when he was being grilled by one of the rulers, by Felix of the day. Acts chapter 24. It really is sort of like a synopsis of the entire gospel, the truth of God. And these are the things we need in our lives, brethren, at all times. And sometimes, especially in challenging times. You know the story, how Paul was actually taken captive. It's kind of amusing as you look at human nature. In this particular case, Paul had been arrested. He'd had this grilling before the Pharisees and Sadducees, probably before the Sanhedrin. In verse 6 of chapter 23, when he perceived that one part on the council were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out, "Men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I'm being judged." And then they start arguing among themselves. There was some concern, it says in verse 10, "Then there arose a great dissension. The commander, fearing that Paul would be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among the council members, the Sanhedrin, and bring him into the barracks." Then there's this rumor that there's a band of Jews that have bound together with an oath saying they're not going to eat until they've killed Paul. And his nephew, his sister's son, comes and tells him that. Paul says, "You get that word to the commander." So then the commander, you notice later in the chapter, look at how people feather their own nests and pad their own account. Verse 20 says, "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix." Here's the Roman commander. "Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him, deserving of death or chains. When it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell." So he'd been taken to Caesarea, bit of a trip. We've made that trip from Jerusalem to Caesarea in that area from our journey in 2019, the Roman headquarters of the area. So he's in Caesarea. Now the Jews come there to talk and to present their case. Herod's Praetorium. Verse 1 of chapter 24, "Now after 5 days, Ananias the high priest came down with elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. They gave evidence to the governor against Paul. So when he was called upon," here's how the accuser states his account of this event. Remember how the Roman soldier stated it? Okay, be prepared for a different story. "He began his accusation saying, 'Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity being brought to this nation by your foresight,'" can you? "'We accepted always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness.'" Gush, 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 drip, drip, drip. "'Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further,'" too late, "'I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him, and we wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander, Lysias, came by and with great violence took him out of our hands.'" Isn't that a little different story? "'Commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. The Jews also assented, maintaining these things were so.'" And look at what Paul says. "After the governor had nodded to him to speak, he answered, 'Inasmuch as I know you've been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. Because you may ascertain that it's no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone or inciting the crowd in the synagogues or in the city, nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me. But I confess this to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things written in the law and the prophets. I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both the just and the unjust. This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men.'" And he tells them what really happened. "After many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, not defiling it, not going against their customs, neither with a mob nor with tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. Or else let those who are here themselves say if they have found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council. Unless it is for this one statement which I cried out, standing among them, saying, 'Concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day.'" There's one interesting book that my wife picked up many years ago, and it makes it's written from the perspective that this author believes that the book of Acts was written by Luke as a kind of a legal defense of the Apostle Paul and some of the things of which he was accused. And from that perspective, it's very interesting. You can see the tone of that right here, of course. But it says, "When Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way," so he had some understanding, "he adjourned the proceedings, and he said, 'When Lysias the commander comes down, I'll make a decision on your case.' So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul, to let him have liberty, told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him." That was part of it. If you got jailed in a Roman jail and they didn't allow your friends to provide for you, you just stayed there until you starved to death. That wasn't exactly a great concept. "After some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ." Now look at what Paul talked to him about. This is like a minicosm of a microsystem of the gospel itself. "Now, as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid." Catch that? "And answered, 'Go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you.' Meanwhile, he also hoped that money would be given him by Paul that he might release him." A little bribe, grease the wheels of justice. Therefore, he sent for him more often and conversed with him and gave him many more chances. Stood there with his hand out. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus succeeded Felix. Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, left Paul bound. What a story. What did he talk to Felix about? And what was Felix's reaction? And what was the reaction we saw in the 23rd Psalm? What did David say? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear. You are with me, and your rod and your staff, they comfort me. What did Felix, who had some knowledge, his wife was Jewish, she probably knew the scriptures to a degree, he had some knowledge of it, as we find here. What was his reaction to being told about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come? He was afraid. What did David say? Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear. What a contrast, brethren. What a contrast. You can see things like this throughout God's Word. You see an instance, a circumstance, I won't go there now, in Luke 7. Go through this procession going on in front of Jesus Christ, where there's a procession of he's coming into the city, and there's a procession coming out with a young man who has died. He stops the funeral procession, speaks to the young man, and brings him back to life. Goings and comings. I doubt whether very many situations, this is the famous crowd going out of Nain, the widow of Nain. She lost her husband, now she lost her only son. I doubt if they come any sadder than that. And Jesus was touched by it, and he intervened. How many people have gone through those things in life without having the comfort they need? Without having the knowledge? You know, God's compassion doesn't only work for the most heart-tugging of cases, but he hasn't intervened in every case in our world. Someday he will. Humanity is on a path that just cannot be rescued unless or until the time he opens their minds. Those of us in the ministry take funerals as an opportunity. We realize that for some people it will be the only time they ever hear the truth. And it's interesting. You can sometimes tell when people are listening by the comments they make to you afterwards as the presenting pastor, and sometimes no, they haven't paid attention to a single word. You can tell the ones who were struck by the fact you didn't preach somebody into heaven and those who heard what they thought they would hear. You know, you'll even hear comments, yes, well, I know she's looking down on us right now. Did you hear a word I said? You're tempted, but you can't. And someday, they will understand. You know, some years ago, at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, they had a series of lectures. But with some of the leading academic people in America, were asked to think deeply about some of the matters that concerned them and then give a hypothetical final talk. In other words, what wisdom would you try to impart to the world if you knew it was your last chance? It was known as the Last Lecture series. That became very well known several years ago when one of the professors at Carnegie Mellon, Randy Posh, was invited to speak on September the 18th, because for him it really was a last lecture. The month before, he'd been told that he had 3 to 6 months of good health left because of pancreatic cancer. In his speech, he discussed everything he wanted his children to know after his pancreatic cancer had taken his life, and his speech went viral back at the time. You can check YouTube and find out how many million views it's had by now, I'm sure. It became a bestseller, his book. He died July 25th, 2008. The concept's kind of intriguing, don't you think? Giving a last lecture. How about a last sermon? In 1992, when my dad was fading very quickly with esophageal cancer, my brother Dave and I made plans to go visit him. We told him we planned to come in May. All he said was, "I think you need to come sooner." We flew out on March the 30th. The next day, he took to his bed. The next day, he went into the hospital. And in the early morning hours of April the 2nd, he died peacefully. On his desk, I found his last sermon. He had never given it. He had prepared it. It was ready to go. But it was his last message, what he would say to the brethren. And it was about God's plan, the perfection of it, where we're headed, what life is about. Brethren, that's what's important. Paul talked to Felix about righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, and Felix was afraid. We read Psalm 23, and we look at those words, and we go through difficult times. We have close friends, family spiritually, that we walk with for years. For years. My wife and I have had the rare opportunity, as it used to be in the ministry, to be in one general area now for 32 and a half years. Poor you. We have some members of the congregation here that for whom I became their pastor in 1989. Please do not talk to Luke Kinsel at any great length about some of those things. She's been very kind. And that means we've gotten to know some people in this area for a long, long time. I first met Leon Leonard at a combined holy day, and I didn't even know the man's name. But it never stopped him from coming up to greet me in a friendly, happy, joyful manner every time I saw him. So I learned his name. That's the way it is in God's way. Yes, it's hard. But when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we can say with David, "I will not fear." That is one of the most important things we can learn in this life. And I know you are grateful and appreciative to the great God who has called us all, and recognize we now, at this time, and whenever these things happen in the future, because they will, we have the responsibility, the opportunity to make sure that the separations are only temporary, and we can talk some more about righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come. And be so appreciative of the truth of the knowledge of God's marvelous, perfect plan.